is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Jackie, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Sunday, November 16th issue of the Viewpoint section of the Buffalo News on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. America at 250, summoning the best in us as we continue to reinvent ourselves. This is a story of an idea. An idea of how human beings might live and coexist in a manner that is just and humane, peaceful and prosperous. An idea about to mark its 250th year, whose time once was, is now, and forever shall be. Compared with those nations that have existed for more than 1,000 years, England, France, and Germany among them, the United States is but an adolescent. In relation to the only two democracies that preceded us, ancient Greece and Rome, we've outlasted the Greeks and are about halfway through the period of Roman self-governance. So, as we ponder where America has been, is now, and will go, beginning tonight with the premiere on PBS of Ken Burns' examination of our wobbly, violent, uncertain, and uplifting revolution, we do well to summon moments in our story that convey our capacity to empathize, adapt, innovate, and improve. Thomas Jefferson was at heart a musician, often humming melodies to himself, thus charming his friends and annoying his adversaries. In May of 1776, Jefferson arrived in Philadelphia, where he would be tasked with drafting America's founding document. Renting the second floor of Jacob and Maria Graff's home at 7th and Market Streets, Jefferson had at the job. On occasion, Maria would climb the stairway to bring Jefferson tea. As she approached the parlor door, she'd hear the sound of violin strings, and upon her knocking, the shy Jefferson would quickly return his violin to its case. Entering the room, Maria would recall years later, she saw handwritten paper sheets askew on the floor, books by John Locke and George Mason, and concealed under Jefferson's desk, his violin. After placing the tea on a side table, Maria would retreat down the stairs. Soon, the notes of a Mozart concerto would again waft through the walls. When Jefferson struggled to find the words to declare America's independence, he didn't take a walk or grab a snack. He sought inspiration in music. The heart of the American idea is individual liberty, the notion that we are born with innate rights that no person or government can bestow or deny, and that the only constraints on us, other than those that prohibit harm to others, are those we place on ourselves. Discipline, forbearance, sacrifice. It's this assertion of individual rights that permits us to rise to whatever social and economic heights that we're able. And whenever we negotiate away these non-negotiable rights of a woman to choose an abortion or a person to refuse an injection, we lose our way. A longtime friend of President John Kennedy once dropped by the White House to see his old pal. Kennedy was immersed in yet another crisis born of the Cold War, and the friend thought perhaps he could use an understanding ear. Entering the Oval Office, the friend was surprised to find the usually jovial Kennedy sitting alone, a distant look on his face as he stared at the wall. Asking the president what was on his mind, Kennedy replied, "I was just thinking that at any moment, some guy's going to walk in here and say, 'Hey fella, what do you think you're doing? We both know that you're not supposed to be here, so get moving.'" At times, I wish I was as certain of one thing as today's politicians seem certain of everything. Seldom is a note of humility struck by our leaders. And never appears what Ralph Waldo Emerson called the anxiety of influence, an acknowledgement of human frailty and ability to question one's own conclusions. We citizens produce this age. We've embraced the lesser nation practice of seeing government as the answer to every problem. The result is our present age of conflating government with nation. America's story may be illustrated by politicians, but it is written by citizens, those of us who believe that government is a force for good, but not for everything. As Americans, we are summoned to never become cross with any fellow citizens because of their views, and we are beckoned to always object when, in our name, our government sells bombs to be dropped on foreign civilians, dispatches masked men to abduct domestic innocents, or denies food to needy citizens due to senseless political bickering. Throughout his long life, during which his powerful oratory and writings inspired blacks to break slavery's chains, Frederick Douglass never forgot Sophia Auld. Born into field slavery in 1818 on Maryland's eastern shore, Douglass witnessed the brutality of enslavement. His plantation owner fed the children from troughs and mercilessly whipped his slaves. At age 10, Douglass was sent to Baltimore to serve in the home of Hugh and Sophia Auld. Upon meeting Sophia, Douglass later wrote, he sensed something was different. Having never owned a slave, Sophia was a woman of the kindest heart and finest feelings. One afternoon, upon learning that Douglass was illiterate, Sophia reached for a book, sat Douglass on her lap, and began to read to him. She taught Douglass how to spell words and form sentences. When her husband discovered this, he exploded in verbal abuse. His outburst caused the wife to stop. But it was too late. From Sophia's reading lessons and her husband's fear of their effect, Douglass realized that he possessed something that no one could enslave, his intellect. Glenn Warner was born in 1871 in Springville, New York. He attended Cornell in his late 20s. His younger classmates call him Pop, practiced law in Buffalo, and became a football coach. Before Pop Warner, it was said that football was overweight men pushing each other around in the mud. His innovations changed the game to what we know today. As coach of the Carlisle Indian Industrial School, every week he taught his players a new intricate play. After they'd mastered it, he'd ask, "Boys, do you want to use it this week, or do you want to save it for the soldiers?" By soldiers, Warner meant the West Point cadets. Always, the Carlisle boys chose to save the new play until they took on Army. Among Warner's Carlisle players in 1912 was a quiet, gifted teenager, Jim Thorpe. That November, Carlisle and Thorpe visited West Point, led by their hard-nosed linebacker, Dwight David Eisenhower. The next day, the New York Times carried a front-page account of the game, in which Carlisle shocked Army 27-6. Asked by a reporter how difficult was it to tackle Thorpe, Eisenhower replied, "It was like trying to clutch a shadow." Before the game, Eisenhower and Thorpe were seen warily eyeing one another. 4 hours later, as they retreated, an injured Eisenhower, he'd broken his leg while playing, was being carried on a stretcher. Spotting Thorpe, Eisenhower asked that his stretcher be put down. Struggling to stand, he called to Thorpe, who walked over to him. Eisenhower extended his hand, and the two embraced. Lost in today's high-pitched, demonizing screeds is perhaps America's most vital idea. The insistence that while no individual be constrained, all government be limited. No government branch, agency, committee, or individual may act without review and accountability. A rejection of the tyranny of the majority that first impelled the women and men of 1776 to break away. A caring, humane idea that those with majority views must account for the rights of the minority. I recently visited the Lexington Green in Massachusetts, where the American Revolution began in April 1775, when 77 colonial men took on 700 British soldiers. The skirmish lasted some 2 minutes and took the life of 8 Americans. When it was over, we were on our own. As I walked across the green on a sun-splashed autumn day, a young family was setting up their picnic not far from where the colonists had taken their stand. As they settled in, the mother read a book as the father lay on his back, his face turned to the sun. Their 3 children chased one another in a game of tag. Kevin Gaughan is a Buffalo attorney and civic leader. You can reach him at kevin@kevingaughan.com. In Everybody's column, Letters from Our Readers, SNAP delays have caused pain for many. Millions of families across the nation are feeling the hunger burn from the recent loss of SNAP benefits, even as the shutdown ends. Growing up as a child in a single-parent household here in Erie County, receiving assistance from publicly funded federal programs such as SNAP was not optional, it was essential. Thankfully, a growing outreach from the Buffalo community has been helping to fill the void. United Way of Buffalo and Erie County is distributing gift cards to Tops Markets, made possible by their donation-based United Way Community Resilience Fund. CAO of Western New York is providing food pantry hours and mobile markets with fresh local produce to certain residents at no cost. Even local businesses such as El Punto Borica and JP's Pub are providing hot food for hungry families who are struggling to provide for themselves. Delaying this program, I fear, has set a dangerous precedent. The implication that the basic needs of the American people can and will be used as a bargaining chip is unacceptable. With a continually increasing cost of living, homelessness has reached an all-time high in 2024 and continues to rise. The leaders of this community must recognize that these hungry people's lives are more than a policy debate, and it is our collective responsibility to continue to remind them of this. Nicholas McCauley, Buffalo. There are 2 sides to tariff and immigration issues. President Lincoln stated that a house divided cannot stand. Presidents Biden and Trump have both used tariffs and exercised immigration laws to remediate fundamental inequities and national indebtedness endemic with today's trade and economic environment. We must achieve a rational perspective on the major issues. Tariffs were used before and since the advent of U.S. federal income tax. Exporters pay a duty on goods shipped to the U.S. They either absorb the charge or pass it on to the consumer. This protects domestic producers and workers from competition due to unfair foreign environmental, labor, and monetary standards. Tariffs may increase prices somewhat, but encourage domestic manufacturing and employment, provide increased revenue, and alternative to deficit spending. They are best viewed as a stabilizing long-term measure. Except for Native Americans, we are a nation of immigrants and continue to benefit from our diversity. However, we are now a developed country with entitlements, borders, and immigration laws. Widespread illegal employment lowers working conditions and wages for citizens. Illegal immigrants usurp social benefits and are gaining political priority. It is disturbing to see federal troops dispatched to troubled cities. Correspondingly, current demonstrations emphasize the political influence of illegal immigrants in our country. Feeding this cacophony are governors and mayors offering sanctuary. This promotes disobedience to federal immigration law and creates systematic lawlessness. In our democratic republic, billionaires and minorities can sometimes gain inordinate influence, but not when there is a majority consensus. Louis L. Baim, Orchard Park. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Viewpoints section of the Buffalo News on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Continuing with everybody's column, we can improve our ecological footprint. Wouldn't it be great if we could get rid of all of our garbage and junk with the snap of a finger? If only. But is it all garbage? Can anything be reused or repurposed? Single-use items are incredibly prevalent in America. Water bottles, plastic cutlery, all one-time use, all temporary conveniences. It might cost more in the moment, but there are reusable options that will save money in the long run and won't sit in landfills for years to come. Even other items that aren't single-use items have become easily disposable. According to the World Population Review, U.S. recycling rates are up to 56% lower than other developed countries. We also generate more waste per capita. Some countries implemented higher recycling rates, incentivized systems, and policies banning certain items from landfills, all to promote recycling. Imagine if we did that here. Unnecessary waste would decrease in no time. We've improved our recycling processes over the years, but are nowhere near where we could be. We have a lot to learn from those who have been engaged to tackling this issue head-on and making a significant impact on the environment. Our choices matter in this world. You might think that you're one person and that you won't make an impact on our ecological footprint. But there are over 7 billion people in the world, and that's a lot of footprints to clean up after. Colby Claus, Lewiston. Concern for maternal health, not enough. Governor Kathy Hochul, in an article in the Buffalo News, proposed new programs to improve infant and maternal health. In this article, she appears to recognize the fetus in the womb of a pregnant woman as a live human being. She appears to be proposing additional governmental aid to assist in improving the health of the fetus in the womb and the health of the mother. Hochul appears to want to help the human being in the first phase of his or her life. This help will be in the form of her initiatives intended to improve infant and maternal mortality rates. Hochul can be commended for her recognizing the unborn human being as both a person and their need for medical help. Unfortunately, she also invites healthy pregnant women from across the country to New York State with the purpose of terminating the life of the fetus in their womb. A true politician seeking votes from both sides of the issue. Edward J. Conboy, Jr., Angola. Cautiously optimistic about democracy. Michael Cracker, Erie County Republican chairman, said in a written statement, "The so-called No Kings rally is nothing more than a Hate America protest sponsored by extreme far-left groups like the Socialist and Communist parties. And these are the same radicals who despise our country's values and want to divide Americans at every turn." My sister and brother-in-law attended the anti-Trump rally. They are bright, well-educated, and civic-minded, as were most of the other attendees. At age 82, I am hopeful that I will outlive the Donald Trump nightmare and our democracy will survive. Regarding democracy, there are those who are doubtful, while others are cautiously optimistic. Only time will tell, but it is sobering to say the least. Peter Lionmark, Hamburg. Heritage Foundation's views are concerning. I wholeheartedly echo the concerns raised in the October 19th letter to the editor regarding biased opinion pieces in the Buffalo News. The very next day, an op-ed appeared by Baruch Feigenbaum, a contributor to the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, arguing against high-speed rail. His piece, devoid of solid facts or scientific evidence, relied on emotional assumptions and cost estimates, a perfect illustration of the issue. The pattern continued a week later with another Heritage Foundation affiliate, Inez Stepman, who on October 27th praised President Trump for attacking colleges and demanded their capitulation to his political demands. This stream of commentary, often lacking substance and rooted in specific political agenda, is concerning. When did embracing proven transportation solutions or having programs for women and minorities to succeed become controversial? This constant fact-averse pushback suggests an embrace of anti-intellectualism and propaganda more typical of authoritarian messaging than healthy public discourse within a democratic system. While other developed nations move forward, the U.S. continues to fall behind in key metrics. It's becoming alarmingly clear how a persistent right-wing bias in published opinion can actively shape public opinion and impede progress. Thank you again to the initial letter writer for highlighting this crucial issue. Jessica Greenwald, Buffalo. In the We Got Mail, 28 letters were received this week. The number one was about the food program, two, the White House ballroom, three, climate goals, four, Republicans, and five, local news. Americans love free speech until someone uses it. If there is one area where Americans still agree, it's that free speech matters. Amid recent political protests, ongoing concerns about speech suppression, and the latest campus controversies, the First Amendment is still immensely popular. In our latest national survey, 81% of Americans claimed freedom of speech should be protected at all costs. This is about as close to unanimity as you get in modern polling. But dig a little deeper, and that consensus starts to fracture fast. Most Americans say certain speech is harmful enough that limits on the First Amendment are necessary. Almost two-thirds agree that free speech doesn't mean protection from consequences. In other words, Americans overwhelmingly believe in free speech, just not necessarily for people who say things they don't like. This is the paradox at the heart of our national conversation. We love the idea of free speech, but we often hate the practice of it. The tension isn't just philosophical, it's emotional. A staggering 79% of Americans believe people are now too quick to cancel others for their opinions. Half of America sees political correctness as a danger to free speech, although the other half isn't as concerned. What tells me this is, as a longtime pollster, Americans are exhausted. They're tired of self-censoring. They're tired of watching their friends and colleagues walk verbal tightropes, and they certainly don't want the government clamping down on speech. But there is nuance here. America isn't a country of free speech abolitionists or thought police. although there are elements of both, ours is really a country of pragmatists. Most Americans believe speech has consequences because they live in a world where words do affect careers, relationships, and reputations. Americans aren't rejecting the First Amendment. They're wrestling with the realities of a digital public square where everyone has a megaphone and nobody has a filter. Here is the real crisis: trust. Americans simply don't trust anyone in power to handle free speech issues fairly. We asked them, and the answers were brutal. Only 21% of U.S. adults trust news organizations. Just 16% trust social media companies even somewhat. Congress? Barely 15%. The only institutions that fare decently are civil rights organizations and independent watchdogs like the ACLU, trusted by 36% and distrusted by just 19%. This is hardly a mandate, but it's something. When every major institution has lost credibility on speech in the eyes of the general public, the most trusted arbiters turn out to be those with no direct power at all. Washington, D.C. should be on high alert. When ABC suspended Jimmy Kimmel's late night show last month, 86% of Americans were aware of it, and 58% opposed the suspension. This includes many Republicans who don't agree with Kimmel on much. What our respondents implicitly told us is that America's patience for corporate gatekeeping is wearing thin. Americans are fed up with institutions acting as moral referees in debates that should belong to the public square. The general public increasingly errs on the side of more expression, not less. Earlier this year, the Sydney Sweeney scandal showed that the anti-speech scolds can only get so far in 2025. The Charlie Kirk tragedy led even some liberals to endorse his style of open debate in remembrance. As the Supreme Court weighs multiple free speech cases this term, Americans seem especially receptive to First Amendment arguments in today's political climate. Based on the polling data, people don't want government censors or social media mobs. They want accountability without authoritarianism, space to speak freely, and room to disagree without fear of exile from the public forum. Free speech in America isn't dying. It's being renegotiated. The real question isn't whether we'll protect it at all costs, but whether we can agree on the price. This is by The Fulcrum. You're listening to a reading of articles and features from the Viewpoints section of the Buffalo News on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In the opinion editorial, keep up the fight. Giving up on climate goals is giving up on New York's future. This is not how climate leadership works. In appealing a court decision holding that New York must comply with its own law and go forward with actions to reduce emissions and support clean energy throughout the state, Governor Kathy Hochul's administration is caving in when it should be doubling down. Hochul also wants to work with state legislature to possibly weaken the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which became law in 2019. In other energy-related actions, the Hochul administration has approved the Northeast Supply Enhancement Project, a gas pipeline that will run under New York Harbor, and signed an agreement that will allow a Finger Lakes gas power plant, Greenidge, that primarily fuels cryptocurrency mining to continue to operate. The Greenwich Agreement does not bode well for opponents of North Tonawanda's DigiHost, a cryptocurrency operation that relies on Fortistar, a gas-burning plant, for power. The operation is causing unacceptable levels of carbon dioxide emissions, as well as noise pollution, and similar to Greenwich, has expired Department of Environmental Conservation air permit. The pipeline and Greenwich decisions are highly problematic. The pipeline had been rejected 3 times by state environmental regulators. But walking back the CLCPA beyond a minor adjustment would be a stunning reversal of science-based climate change mitigation policy. New York's climate plan should still guide the state's action, as the court decision held. It will probably take a few years longer to achieve its goals, which is all the more reason to redouble efforts to lessen that delay. The lawsuit filed by Push Buffalo, Citizens Action of New York, Sierra Club, and We Act for Environmental Justice in April, that was decided in their favor on October 24th, was about setting actions in motion that would ensure that climate goals would be met. Rules and regulations were needed to accompany the passing of the CLCPA, and New York has been slow to take such action. As reported by the news, Mackenzie Schumann, Albany County Supreme Court Justice Julian D. Schreibman's ruling was that New York's Department of Environmental Conservation must issue new regulations to ensure New York meets its greenhouse gas reduction goals. A major issue here is that the state's yet-to-be-implemented Cap and Invest program, which would set a declining cap on greenhouse gas emissions, allowed. Manufacturers, power plants, and fuel companies would then need to pay to pollute. The money from those sales would go towards energy bill rebates and reinvestment in emission reduction initiatives, such as building electrification. But despite this potential for reducing costs for ratepayers, the program has not been initiated. Hochul's concerns about New York ratepayers are justified. Without significant advancements in modernizing the grid so that more renewable projects can connect to it, individual ratepayers will end up footing the bill for the energy transition. Clean energy advocates and leaders like State Senator Liz Krueger say that instituting Cap and Invest is a good way to alleviate those costs. Outside studies say that low and moderate income households would likely see a net savings from the policy. Clean energy isn't going away, despite political headwinds from the White House. Renewables have dominated U.S. energy capacity growth, accounting for 93% of additions, 30.2 gigawatts through September 2025, with solar and storage making up 83%. Clean energy is big business and should be embraced to the same extent that New York is embracing innovation in AI and microchip technology. Indeed, such a complementary approach is necessary because of the high energy demands of these industries. Innovation should not be unsustainable. Energy storage systems, grid modernization, and clean generation technologies must move forward in New York, along with AI and advanced manufacturing. If the Hochul administration wants to work with the legislature to make a moderate adjustment in the climate goal timeline, it must demonstrate that it is moving aggressively toward a clean energy future, not continuing to enable the fossil fuel industry and all the pollution that comes with it. Another voice, weather. Buffalo needs better infrastructure for storms, by Sienna Jarozuski. Buffalo is no stranger to winter weather and has faced numerous deadly storms. As someone proud to call Buffalo home, I agree that we must be equipped to handle what nature brings. But the storms we face today aren't the storms our infrastructure was built for. As climate change fuels harsher lake effect events and unpredictable weather, our roads, power systems, and emergency response plans lag dangerously behind. On November 2014, lake effect snow covered the southern region, dumping 7 feet of snow. Roofs collapsed. Travel bans left people stranded. What startled many wasn't just the amount of snow, but the timing, which shattered the illusion that harsh storms only arrive in deep winter. It proved that perilous events can hit before we're even done raking leaves. But Snowvember wasn't an anomaly. In November of 2022, massive lake effect events pummeled the area. My hometown, Hamburg, saw over 80 inches of snow. This is the new normal. Storms come earlier, hit harder, and our infrastructure cannot keep up. Our power grid still relies on above-ground lines vulnerable to ice, sleet, and high winds. Our roads deteriorate quickly under erratic freeze-thaw cycles brought on by climate change, creating potholes and weakening pavement when emergency access is most critical. Stormwater systems struggle when snowmelt overwhelms aging pipes, especially in neighborhoods that have historically seen underinvestment. However, a more resilient Buffalo is within reach. Strengthening the electrical grid by burying power lines along critical corridors and developing microgrids would reduce widespread outages. Redesigning emergency routes, improving plow coordination, and investing in winter-reliable transit would make emergency workers safer and more efficient. Solutions like permeable pavement and renovated stormwater management can reduce flooding and relieve pressure on overburdened systems. Such investments are not luxuries. They are necessities. We cannot afford to keep reacting to each disaster as if it were unexpected. Buffalo's spirit is defined by its grit and generosity. Now we need infrastructure capable of matching that spirit. A safer and stronger Buffalo is possible, but it requires action before the next storm, not after. Sienna Jaruzelski is studying public affairs and policy at Brown University. In the My View column, Bulls, Bills, or Bisons, It's All Good, by Michael Scully. I can very accurately refer to myself as a sports fan and devoted member of Bills Mafia. I didn't really start playing and following sports until I was 10 years old, when my family settled in Buffalo for good after living in various locations around the country. When I started paying attention to sports, baseball was the clear king. My dad took my sisters and me to some Bisons games and also to Major League games in Cleveland. The first Major League game we attended was a 1970 doubleheader between the Indians and the Red Sox that featured a bench-clearing brawl in the second game. In these days of streaming and cable TV, one can gain access to virtually any sporting event they want to watch. But during the 1970s, there was only one Major League Baseball game of the week, available for viewing on Saturday afternoons. I looked forward to these games with eager anticipation and would watch attentively as Kurt Gowdy and Tony Kubek described the action. While I also began watching Bills, Sabres, and Buffalo Braves games, baseball was definitely my favorite sport growing up. At some point, due to my growing devotion to our local NFL team, football overtook baseball. The first Bills game I ever attended was in the 1975 season opener against the Jets. It was a beautiful September afternoon, and the Bills, led by quarterback Joe Ferguson and O.J. Simpson's 173 yards rushing, crushed Joe Namath and the Jets 42-14. I was hooked. Since that first visit, I've returned to Highmark Stadium many times to root for our Bills through the lean and prosperous times. While I've attended hundreds of sporting events in my life, including hockey, basketball, and lacrosse contests, for me, there's nothing that matches the intrigue and excitement of a football game. Two of the most memorable games for me were our stunning comeback in the 1992 playoff game against the Oilers and the AFC Championship win over the Chiefs in 1994 that sent us to our fourth straight Super Bowl. As a football fan, I find that we actually have the best of both worlds here in Western New York. While there's nothing like experiencing an NFL game in person, I've also had the pleasure of going to numerous UB Bulls football games at UB Stadium over the years. The contrast when going to a UB game as opposed to a Bills game is refreshing in many ways. A UB game is much more affordable and family-friendly without the borderline hysteria that sometimes manifests itself at NFL stadiums. I always feel such a great vibe at UB sporting events, including basketball games. The marching band, cheerleaders, and dance teams add to the fun, upbeat atmosphere. And for someone who loves football, there's nothing like actually being there. The Bulls have had an entertaining 2025 season, with four consecutive games coming down to the last possession before the issue was decided. Amazingly, the Bills currently have no less than three former UB players on their active roster. And incredibly, the top two all-time college football leaders in forced fumbles are UB players. This season, UB linebacker Red Murdoch broke former UB great Khalil Mack's record with his 17th career forced fumble in the November 1st victory over Bowling Green. My View is a first-person column open to all Western New Yorkers. If your article is selected for publication, a photo of you is required. Email submissions to editpage@buffnews.com. Dems won victory in defeat. Now they just need to realize it. By Susan Estrich. In 1940, Winston Churchill ordered the evacuation of 338,000 troops facing annihilation on the beaches of Dunkirk. Churchill called the successful operation a miracle of deliverance. Historians portray it as a perfect example of victory in defeat. Democrats, raging at eight members of their caucus for ending the government shutdown, might take a few lessons from the master of morale and strategy. What some hotheads framed as capitulation is, in the long run, the wisest plan. Right after Dunkirk, Churchill famously said, "Wars are not won by evacuations." That is so, but stopping a potential disaster lets your side fight another day. Ending the shutdown prevented negative outcomes that had begun chugging the Democrats' way. Shutdowns almost always bite the party that starts them. The record for this is so strong that I thought Democrats had erred from day one. I was wrong. Democrats effectively used the headlines to highlight the issues sure to haunt Republicans come the midterms: the soaring cost of health care. Democrats prevailed in the recent elections, partly on threats to their health coverage, partly on rising food prices, tariff chaos, and in-your-face corruption. But at a certain point, the news started turning from the fight to extend the Obamacare subsidies to flights being canceled and the poor losing food assistance. With Thanksgiving approaching, The sight of family members sitting on suitcases in airports is not optimal. As many more Americans feel shutdown pain at the personal level, Democrats are harder pressed to avoid blame, even if the public liked certain items they were fighting for. Now, some firebrands just want to fight. But their contention that reopening the government has caused a loss of leverage is based on illusion. Democrats never held meaningful leverage because they don't have the votes. Republicans control the White House, the House, and the Senate. To quote Barack Obama, elections have consequences. The election of Trump and mostly pliant Republican Congress created such consequences as attacks on Obamacare and, more ominously, our democratic institutions. The Democrats' winning message should be, elect us and we will restore health care security. Even the temporary loss of it will hit home. Now, if the shutdown worked in avoiding even some pain, that wouldn't be an argument in favor, but it wasn't. Speaking for Democrats who voted to reopen the government, Maine Senator Angus King, an independent, posed the right question. Does the shutdown further the goal of achieving some needed support for the extension of the tax credits? He's referring to credits that were temporarily increased during the pandemic, making coverage cheaper for millions. These senators come from the swing states of Nevada, Virginia, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, and Maine. They are key to Democrats obtaining and keeping a majority in Congress. Without them, Democrats have no hope of obtaining real power. And without real power, their politics are just performance. As noted, the shutdown did succeed in putting the specter of lost health coverage front and center. That mission has been accomplished. Trump's now railing that Obamacare is a scam to get the insurance companies filthy rich. Democrats should thank him for calling this revered benefit a scam. Assessing the dire situation at Dunkirk, Churchill chose not to make a heroic yet suicidal stand, but he followed closely with his immortal, "We shall fight on the beaches" speech, a rally to the nation for continued resistance. The midterms are the beaches that Democrats should be storming. From the Creators Syndicate. I don't get it. Why did the Democrats choose to just cave in? By Froma Haroop. Why start something that you don't have the guts to follow through with? Why grab defeat from the jaws of victory? Barely a week after the best election night Democrats have had in years, with the president's approval ranking hitting new lows, with voters deserting him on the economy and immigration, what do the Democrats do? They cave, or at least eight of them did. By carefully self-selecting to include no one who is up for re-election, and two who are retiring, they gave the president the victory he wanted and he claimed. Why did they do it? Because the country was blaming the Democrats? That dog don't hunt. Republicans control the White House, the executive branch, the House, the Senate, and the Supreme Court. If your check doesn't come, how can it be the fault of the powerless Democrats? The polls were showing the public putting the blame on Republicans. Even President Trump was showing pressure, beginning to lean on Republicans. As for the pain, it wasn't the Democrats still running to the Supreme Court, so they won't have to provide full food stamps this month. It wasn't the Democrats insisting that air traffic controllers not be paid and that air traffic had to be curtailed. This was Trump's shutdown. Obamacare subsidies should have been the price Trump had to pay to end it, until Democrats let him off the hook. Do we get brownie points for being responsible? for avoiding the hardships of a continued shutdown? I wouldn't count on it. Clearly, Democrats aren't counting on it, or they might have included among the number of defectors some who would be up in another year. The fact that Democrats are plainly worried about the wrath of Democrats, let alone future primary challenges, tells you everything that is wrong about this vote to reopen the government. Was there ever an endgame other than this? The White House and the Republicans had only two alternatives, other than to let the shutdown drag on. One, that they've claimed they didn't have the votes for, was to jam legislation through the Senate, which would have gotten rid of the long-treasured filibuster, so that a bare majority could reopen the government. That would not do the Democrats any good, that is, until and unless they recapture the Senate. The second would have been to cut a deal with Democrats on the Obamacare subsidies, the path the Democrats proposed last week and Republicans soundly rejected. Consideration of the possible endgames leads to a brick wall. If there was no endgame, why start the game in the first place? Why play the game if the inevitable ending is that you lose? Some of my Democratic friends, trying to make the best of what is a trying situation, argue that the Group of Eight did what was right for the country, if not for the partisan politics. Were we really prepared to sit back and watch families go hungry to score political points? Were we really prepared for air traffic to dwindle to a trickle? What was being promised or threatened, with all the economic and human costs that that would bring? Someone had to do the right thing and end the insanity before even more federal workers get fired, more programs people rely on get cut, and the bureaucracy grinds down and people suffer as a result. Who will be blamed for the shutdown, who will get credit for its end, and whether that blame or credit will matter in the long run remains to be seen. The one thing this week's move is sure to stoke is the frustration with the leadership, or lack thereof, of the National Democratic Party. Poor Chuck Schumer. There's no explaining this one on late night TV. They don't get it either. In the drawn-out debate, political cartoonists from across the country react to the end of the government shutdown. In this first picture, it is a cartoon by Mike Lukovich, there is a big laundromat sign, and you see lots of people standing at a table with their laundry. Now, the people that you see standing are recognizable faces from the Senate. And there is a person on the right-hand side who is standing there looking at the people standing at the table with their folding their laundry. And the bubble cartoon says, "Sigh, Democrats folding." In the next cartoon, there is a Republican symbol, the donkey, pushing a wheelchair. The wheelchair has a very old person in it, in a suit with glasses. The Republican is pushing the wheelchair right towards a steep cliff. The cartoon caption reads, "The Schumer Shutdown, Phase 2." The next cartoon has a picture of the White House, and the bubble above that picture says, "The Democrats accepted the shutdown deal. We promised to negotiate on health care subsidies. We promised to negotiate on health care subsidies soon." The next frame over, all around the Capitol, there's ha 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 ha. The next cartoon has a picture of a man in a suit. His arm is raised up high. He has a label on his suit that says Congress. He's holding a newspaper that says government shutdown ending? Question mark. As he holds his hand up, the bubble over his head says high five. There is a woman looking straight at him. Her bubble says, sorry, after 40 days of chaos and anxiety, the most I can offer you is one finger. And the final cartoon has the Republican symbol, the donkey. He's sitting in a high chair, and there is a little sippy cup that is being thrown off of the high chair. Next to him is the elephant, the Democratic symbol, and both of these two characters are covered in what looks like baby food. And on the table in front of them, there is a spilled cup that is labeled budget, and another cup labeled CR. They're throwing food at each other, it's splashing everywhere, the table is covered. And the headline of this cartoon reads, "The Budget Battle Ends." There is a cartoon on the opinion page by Adam Ziglis, who is from the Buffalo News. It is a picture of a farm. In the background, there is a barn with the title on it that says Farms. Next to the barn is a silo. Then in the foreground, there is a farmer who is kneeling on the ground. His head is laying on a big stump. He is laying on the ground, he's kneeling on the ground. His hands are tied behind his back. He is dressed like a farmer. Standing next to him is a turkey. The turkey has the head of the turkey is President Trump's head, and in the turkey's mouth is a hatchet, and the hatchet looks to be heading to swing towards the farmer's neck, as you would see someone cutting off the head of the turkey, but this is the head of the farmer, and the hatchet has a label on it that says tariffs. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Sunday, November 16th issue of the Viewpoints section of the Buffalo News. We read from the Viewpoints section of the Buffalo News every Sunday at 6 p.m. Your reader has been Jackie. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next in the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have the National Enquirer. At 8 p.m., we have People Magazine. And at 9 o'clock, we have the New York Times Book Review. Stay tuned for these readings and more. And if you have any comments, suggestions, or questions, please stay with us. If you're listening to this publication online, you're probably using our website, a podcast player like Spotify or iTunes, a streaming service like Siro, or a smart speaker. Did you know that we now have a dedicated app that can be downloaded to any mobile device, like a smartphone or tablet, for free? App users can conveniently access our live stream and any episode of our podcast easier than ever. To download the app, just type NFRRS in the search window in the Apple App Store or in the Google Play Store. Contact us anytime if you have any questions by calling 716-821-5555, extension 5. Thank you. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision,